your plans were secret when you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all.
And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. Tom Esker. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
Record everything here too, right?
Yeah.
I
always do, and then I can keep track of what I said. Actually, I don't change my spiel very much. No, they charged all of the people who was on the property that night with burning refuse material without a permit.
That's all they could kind of stick on you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and then they kicked it out of court three times, and they kept coming back. 9 years that case lingered on, and we wouldn't give in.
All right, so while we're on the subject, let me just back up a little bit.
Sure.
Name and spelling, just for the editor back in the...
Tom Metzger, that's Metzger.
All right, Tom, what would we title you as?
I'm the director of White Aryan Resistance.
All right, big news came out from the Supreme Court today. You obviously read about it. You heard about it. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, I remember when Thomas Jefferson referred to the Supreme Court as 9 old men who could decide anything means anything, but now they'll have to say 8 old men and 1 woman. their PC go with the flow, and of course the Klan is low on the pecking order. I mean, high on the pecking order. They don't have any power or money anymore, so pick on the Klan. I have, before 1980, when I left the Klan, was involved in a lot of cross lightings, in ceremony on private property, never on somebody's yard. I would have been the first to jump on somebody that would have done something like that. So if they mean, you know, it's against the law to intimidate somebody on their yard, I agree. I don't believe in doing that either. But if they mean they can't go onto their own property, like a farm or out in the woods or something, on their own property and light a cross, then I tell the government to go to hell.
And you've actually been prosecuted. Hang on one second. I'm going to try this. You were just telling me a story. You actually got prosecuted for doing that.
Yes. I was invited to give a speech, and the group, part of the group was Klan, part were two or three other groups, and so I agreed to give a speech. So I went to Los Angeles and out in Cable Canyon, and I was standing up by the house, and it was on private property with permission, and the police and the fire department, everybody else raided the place and arrested about, I don't know, 15 of us. That case went on for 9 years, and we fought them down to the wire, and they finally got me for illegal assembly, and I don't understand that on private property, but I did 45 days in county jail, which was quite an experience. They put me in high power with all the killers. And when I come down the stairs, when they brought us all chained together in orange suits, and I was the last guy, the black guy says, "Oh my God, there goes Hannibal the Cannibal."
All right, so you're not against the law if it pertains to the threatening aspect of burning it on someone's front lawn.
I never did believe in that, and I never did do it. And anybody, when I was running the Klan and I caught in my outfit doing something like that, I would call it cowardly. But for private ceremonies by the official Klan groups, it should be perfectly all right, just as all right as any religious or any church or any political party's gatherings.
What does it actually symbolize? What how did it start, and what does it really symbolize?
Well, the burning or lighting of the cross goes back to Scotland, actually, and before they were Christianized, they used to burn bonfires on top of the mountains to call all the tribes together to fight the common enemy. Usually it was the English. And so as they became Christianized, they used the cross, and what they would do, the Scot tribes would take a small cross out of wood and dip it in either animal blood or fruit juice, and they'd ride through the countryside, and when they presented that to the tribe next door, that meant everybody between the age of 15 and like 60 had to come with their weapons and fight. And then it gradually became a tradition to fire the cross, and they, as far as I know, they still fire the cross at the Scottish Games over in Scotland. But then, of course, a lot of our ancestors that came from Scotland, Scotch Presbyterian, who lived in the South, they picked it up and used it for the Ku Klux Klan.
So, I mean, back in the day, was that to symbolize, I mean, to strike fear? Was that...
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was to make your friends feel good and make your enemies sort of be good. And I think it was a political warning, just like the government warns us all the time, sends us a message all the time. So the Klan used to send a message out: if people are good and treat each other right, everything's going to be okay.
So now, I mean, if you were to go someplace or have your own gathering and wanted to do this on your own property, it's against the law.
Well, I haven't read the law, but I imagine it's probably okay still to have it on private property in a non-threatening manner. But I wouldn't do it anymore, and I don't even go to gatherings anymore because they're so heavily infiltrated with federal agents and provocateurs that it's dangerous to go. I advise all my people, my associates, don't go to any of this kind of stuff, because it's a trap.
Well, in here, I just read the article rather briefly. They were these justices sitting up there. The big discussion was over the First Amendment right. Do you think it's a violation of our rights by them saying, no, we can't do anything?
Well, if they say that you can't do it on your own private property or with permission on property, then of course it's a violation of the First Amendment, and I would tell them to go to hell, because I listen to what the Bill of Rights says, and it says we supposedly still have free speech. And if the supreme swine, as I sometimes call them, want to rule against free speech, they're going to suffer the consequences. I have no use for Washington.
Well, speaking of Washington and somewhat switching gears, out of curiosity, I just want to hear your view on our little ongoing war.
Well, I'm 100% against the war. I was in the military. I know what it's like. I've seen what happened in Korea. The white working man didn't get anything out of Korea except getting killed. And they ended up with an armistice where neither side won. And then we had Vietnam. What did the white working man get out of Vietnam, or for that matter, any working man? These are all wars for power, greed, and you name it. And so now we got another one, and it's all mixed up with oil and protecting their little pet Israel. And Israel's about bankrupt, and so we had to go fight the war for them because they can't afford to fight the war. So, no, I would say, you know, in the Vietnam War, at least half of the war, I was for the war. But when I saw my friends coming back in body bags here at Camp Pendleton, I changed my mind. I said, they're not trying to even win the war. So I will not promote these international wars. Why does somebody have to go 10,000 miles from here to protect my freedom? I want them to go right here and protect my freedom on the border and the invasion we're getting from the third world. My freedom is going away. The Homeland Security and the Patriots Act II is taking away all our liberty, using the excuse of terrorism that's way over there, or the WTC, which was obviously just an attack on the World Trade Center as a financial center of world trade, and on the Pentagon as the bully boys who back up the world trade thing. And I don't see it was an attack on America at all.
Even though there were 3,000 people?
It's terrible. It's terrible. And I what can I do? I said for years, it's coming. It's going to happen. I don't know where it's going to happen, but it's coming. You keep sticking a stick into a cage in an animal's face, and he's going to come out. If he gets out of that cage, he's going to kill you. And United States economic warlords are trying to screw over the Arab people. And I believe the Arab people have every right to defend themselves. Now, I don't want the Arabs coming here. I would like to get every non-white Arab out of this country and back there. But every time our government goes into these third world countries, they screw them up so bad, then they all want to come over here. And if we'd quit having these silly uproars and leave people alone, I'm a great one for saying, leave them alone. Leave Nicaragua alone. Leave Grenada alone. Leave the Koreans alone. Leave people do their thing, you know, and not get involved. And then we won't have millions of people coming over here. We don't have the room.
Running out of it. Is there anything else, I mean, about the either one?
Well, this is not a very important issue at all, because there's not very many Klans around anymore anyhow, and not too many of them are doing much anyhow. So I think it's sort of, closing the door after the horse is gone or something. So, but I stand with the Klan on this issue. Any government official that tells me I can't do something that's safe on my own property with permission, then he is the criminal, not me.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
As always.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're going to hit all that shitty traffic.
Well, I guess we could go on and do it.
Okay.
You can hear me, I can hear you.
Yeah, I can hear you okay.
Okay.
Okay, you all set to go?
Sure.
Okay, it's March the 18th, 2003. This is George Michael, and I'm interviewing Mr. Tom Metzger, the founder and leader of White Aryan Resistance, or WAR. Okay, good evening, Mr. Metzger.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Just fine.
Okay, I assume you had a little bit of time to look at my questions.
Yeah.
The first one, the September 11th attacks. The far right's response seems to be ambivalent. In one sense, they I think feel a sense of vindication insofar as a lot of the issues about which they feel strongly, like immigration and American foreign policy, figured very prominently in the attacks. But there also seems to be this fear that the government's response to international terrorism that spill over against domestic extremists. What do you think the net effect will be of 9/11? Will it be good or bad for the far right?
Well, I think in the short run it's going to be bad because it's given the central government an excuse to create this monstrosity they call the Patriots Defense Department. And I think since they have such a hard time locating foreign terrorists, that they will concentrate on what they would suspect as being domestic terrorists. And so they're going to go down the pecking order, and I think that we're considered to be at the top. Now, as far as my position was very clear, was simply saying that the chickens have come home to roost, that I'm not connected with any Arab groups or anything like that, and I surely don't want the Muslims gaining any more foothold in North America or Europe, either one. And I happen to have supported the Yugoslavians, the Serbians, and so forth against the Muslims in that war. But I have been predicting and warning and talking about, and people can go back and listen to my updates for a few years ago, and saying, look, it's coming, it's going to happen, and you keep pushing a stick into the cage of an animal, he's going to get out. If he gets out, he'll try to kill you. And I saw it, and I think many other people in the, I consider myself a racial separatist, I can borrow from the left or the right, I certainly don't consider myself the far right, but I think that the targets were extremely symbolic and had very little to do with the population of the United States. It had to do with the single most prominent symbol of the transnational corporate economic power, and that was that World Trade Center. And as far, and the hitting of the Pentagon was obviously symbolic of the going to the heart of the beast of the military might that sustains this corporate structure around the world. Beyond that, I didn't see it as an attack on America itself at all.
I see. Yeah, several Bush administration representatives have said that the attacks were visited upon America because of the values that America espouses, its freedom, its democracy. Do you accept that analysis?
Absolutely not, and it's so simplistic as to be almost laughable. The United States fell into the trap a long time ago with the encouragement, I guess, of the fundamentalist Christians and so forth of getting into bed with Israel and financing Israel, supporting Israel, allowing Israel to either steal or buy nuclear material, gave them a subsidy of billions per year and so forth, and it was like sticking your finger in the eye of the Arabs. Now, we, in the old days, we had no big problem with the Arabs, and gasoline oil was cheap, but with our continued strange romance with Israel, it infuriated the Arabs more and more and more. Now, the excuse that they used to use was that Israel was valuable in our struggle ideologically and intelligence-wise with Russia. I never did believe it was that important, but at least that's what we were sold. But once the Soviet Union had crumbled, really no need for us to have this joint-at-the-hip relationship with Israel other than a strong Israel lobby and the fundamentalist Christians in this country. And so that caused our gasoline and oil to skyrocket, and because Japan was already tooled up for small cars and we weren't, well, Japan took over the automobile industry for small cars, and almost every happened to us economically since can be traced back to this unholy alliance with Israel.
I see. As I'm sure you know, this war on terror is going to be very expensive. Furthermore, a lot of these state budgets are in a really bad fiscal situation as well. I suppose one of the reasons is immigration. Do you think there's a possibility that the U.S. could be winning militarily overseas, but then perhaps suffer some consequences at home because of immigration on the Mexican border, and that conceivably that the government could spiral into bankruptcy and civil unrest?
Well, technically, if you were to judge an individual or a family's finances by in the same way you would the government's finances, they're already bankrupt, and we're simply borrowing trillions of dollars against the future. And as any family would find out or know, or any individual would know, that that's like playing light in a poker game. It also causes your country to be sold off to foreign interests even more than it is already. And so with the influx of millions of people from the so-called third world, people with such a variety of religions and racial and ethnic backgrounds and so forth, and the fact that the economy is not good and that there's no really good outlook for better job situation in the United States, the chemicals are already there for a civil war or an upheaval in this country at some time and not too distant future as far as I can see.
Do you see the state of California as the vanguard in that respect?
Yes, I do. I agree with Thomas Chittum, who wrote the book Civil War II, that may not be played out exactly that way, but I see California as being pivotal to the beginning of an upheaval in the United States. And it's going to come, as far as I can say, and my opinion is, it'll come from all kinds of groups and dissidents, whether they be the Aztlan people or whether they be Mexican people who want to carve out the Southwest, or whether it be the black nationalists and what they want to do or what we want to do. I think it's going to create some very strange bedfellows in the very near future.
That's very interesting. In recent years, the proliferation of the Internet technology and the World Wide Web has enabled people from all over the world to communicate with one another. Do you see a process of cross-fertilization whereby seemingly disparate dissidents are able to communicate with one another, and there's an increasing convergence of an ideology centered on a shared ideology, say, with regard to globalization, the New World Order?
Yes, it reminds me somewhat of the first Star Wars film of the various groups allied against the Empire. And I think that people who do not necessarily want to live together, being even in the same country, can come to the conclusion that the government itself is more of a threat and an enemy than they are to each other at that moment, and then they can solve their problems later on. I think that's what you're going to see more and more of, and of course this cross-pollinization is really in high gear all over the world with the Internet.
Yeah, it's a very interesting development.
And I would think that probably the powers that be are going to at some point do their best to curtail dissident communication.
Yeah, it's going to be a tall order, though, to do that, though, because I don't know if we'll have the ability to really contain that kind of technology.
Well, that's the way I feel about it, that there's very little that I or people who agree with me have to do. We believe that the central government of the United States is painting itself into a corner themselves and laying the groundwork for their own destruction without hardly any intervention at all from any other source. And it seems like It's the same always with the government. They always want to get bigger, more powerful, and then the main thing they do then is to protect themselves. And they become so giant and unwieldy that they spend all their time protecting the state. And that's what's beginning to happen now, to where the political parties and the common man really have nothing much in common. That everything is circle the wagons, whether it be the courts, whether it be economy, or whatever it may be, and protect the elitists and those in power. And I say, well, that plays right into my hands because it creates more and more dissidents.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Getting to this, back to this notion of strange bedfellows that you mentioned, I observe that militant Islam and right-wing extremism share some characteristics, or at least a very similar critique on certain issues like American foreign policy, the New World Order, globalization, Zionism, etc. What do you think are the prospects for, say, some kind of an alliance or a meeting of the minds between the two organizations? Now, I know I read an article on War about 5 or 6 years ago. I think you criticized this notion of European right-wingers reaching out to Palestinians. So what's your take on this?
Well, I felt that, and I still feel that this is something that has to be handled very carefully, because first of all, we must demand the exclusion of the Muslim non-white people from North America. But we also realize it's because of our own government and transnational corporate meddling that causes people to flee their countries and so forth, because we support and we finance the dictators that caused the problem in the first place. But it's a very sticky situation. Now, as far as the Palestinians, one can have sympathies now and then, but on the other hand, we feel too that the Arabs, they could get together and solve that problem fairly simply, but they don't seem to want. Now, Arabs are the type that's very difficult to deal with, because it's very difficult for them to deal even with each other, and they have a very tough time coming to any kind of serious accommodation among themselves. I believe that the white race, the European people and Americans, must push the Muslims back and keep them out of Europe, as the Muslims invaded. I've been in places in Europe where the Muslims had fought their way all the way to Holland and places like that, and we beat them back. We want nothing to do with the Muslim religion, and since Muslim religion, like some other religions, promote miscegenation and race mixing, then it is an enemy. But we can also, even though something can be an enemy, we can have certain sympathies with some of the problems that they have run into, and see that it's not all their fault. And so some of the right wing, have gone a little bit overboard, I think, with this. And there's a lot of disingenuous propaganda floating around by people who really don't like the Jews, but they'll use the Palestinians as simply an excuse and saying, oh, look at the poor Palestinians. What they'd really like to say is, we hate the Jews, but they don't have the guts to do it.
Okay, yeah, so you think they're just crying crocodile tears?
I don't think that they're serious about aiding at all the Palestinian people.
Okay.
But the Palestinian people, the problem with them, those people too, and when I was in New York a few years ago, there was a big pro-Palestinian parade, and it was totally taken over by extreme leftist Marxist groups in this country, and I felt that was an extremely bad mistake for the Palestinians to end up in that bed. Here I was going to more or less support them, and I go down to the parade, and I see nothing but Marxist flags and so forth. And then they're out there fighting with the Jewish Defense League and people like that, which, in other words, I just turn around and go home, you know.
do Arabs or Muslims ever contact you, try to reach out to you, and vice versa? Have you ever tried to build any bridges?
Well, I was invited to Libya in 1985, as I recall, through the Canadians, and I was poised to go to Libya on that trip, but I had a court case in Los Angeles I couldn't get out of, so I did not go. And that was back when they were pushing the green, the little green book and all that, and it become quite popular among a lot of right-wingers, probably more in Europe and in Australia.
With the British part, right?
Right. Well, some. And like that. But I didn't go on that trip. In a way, I'm glad I didn't, because it became somewhat of a fiasco, I understand. The black militants and so forth were incensed that the white racist nationalists or whatever were on the same trip, and there was one reporter who was murdered on that trip. He was pushed off a building.
That's right. I recall reading that now.
Right. And then just a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, it's hard to gauge the time, there was a plan working for me to go to Iraq. And my friend Dennis Mahon had contact with evidently the Iraq embassy, and I think that the contact was made because we came out against the war in the Middle East, the first war, and opposed it, and he even went so far, Mahon did, to turn in his medals that he gained in the military, that he was ashamed that we were even involved in that. So I guess that I don't know who made the first contact, but somehow there was some conversation between Mr. Mahon and the Iraqi people, and there for a while it looked like we were going to take a trip to Iraq, but it never came through.
Okay, do you know if Mr. Mahon had any other success with the Iraqis, or the
not since that time, no.
Okay. Yeah, I know Louis Farrakhan had gone over there probably about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yes.
I think he met with Saddam Hussein.
Well, yes, it's much easier for Farrakhan and people like that to, especially non-white people, to go there, I guess, than white separatist nationalists. But I think it's too bad in a way, because I think when I deal with people, I deal with people strictly, straight up, and look, this is what I am, this is what you are. Now, if there's something we can work on together, fine. But I'm not here to tell you I'm not a racist and like that, you know. But I think it's a trap for the white nationalist, white separatists to crawl in bed with the Arabs.
Yeah, a few, I think, like Ahmed Huber from Switzerland and David Myatt have been involved in that.
Yes.
It would seem to be a very risky enterprise, because my previous research indicates that the far right is very closely monitored by not only the government, by these private watchdog groups, and so they would be really vulnerable if they were to associate themselves with, I think, with, say, the likes of Al-Qaeda.
Well, yes, they would, and that's true. However, the investigative arm of the famous but incompetent, I call them, up until now has not been much to get excited about, because at the same time they spent 2 years following my friend Alex Curtis in San Diego around, because he was handing out and putting literature up on telephone poles. Just a few blocks away was the Al-Qaeda people, who actually ended up ramming the airplane into the World Trade Center. They came in evidently through the Mexican border and lived there for some time, and nobody ever even asked them a question. So they've got probably more agents, but sometimes I wonder how efficient their intelligence agencies are.
Yeah, getting back to that, you've heard of the Project Megiddo report that came out in late 1999?
Yes, I did hear that name, yeah.
Yeah, there was no mention of Muslim extremists in the report. It centered on primarily so-called right-wing extremists.
Well, that's obvious, simply because because the United States was making deals with these people. I mean, Rumsfeld, as far as I'm concerned, is an unindicted war criminal. I mean, the man is like the drug cartel that supplies the drugs to the street dealer. He supplied the weapons, he supplied the gas that Hussein was allegedly used on Kurds and so forth, and we've given these people all these weapons, and then when they use them, and then we, if they use them the wrong way, well then we want to have a war with them. This is insane. I would certainly hope that George Bush is a one-term president. I think that things would be a lot different if we had Al Gore had won, and I'm surely not a Gore, great big Gore fan. I don't like most of these people, but I think once George Bush was allowed in and the whole pro-Israeli lobby, Ashcroft with his fanatical Christian positions and so forth, that the Arabs just said, well, there's no use even talking anymore because these people just won't listen.
I guess, in a sense, one could argue that the far right enables the Islamic extremists to get more done in the United States because the far-right extremists soak up so much of the resources.
Yeah.
For example, Chester Dulles, his house was raided by 60 agents.
Right.
So that's tying up an awful lot of federal resources for a seemingly innocuous person like that.
Right. You're exactly right. They're prodded on by the Anti-Defamation League and all these people that continually are inflaming all their supporters to the point of scaring the hell out of them that either the Nazis are coming or here comes the Klan and hide, run for your life and all that, to the point where these people are continually putting abnormal pressure on these FBI and so forth, and they just evidently react just to keep these people almost out of their hair. Or maybe they just feel this is an easy way to make big headlines and everybody will think we're doing our job.
Like Waco in 93 with the ATF.
Right.
Yeah, they were expecting a big show arrest.
Right.
The way they planned.
Right.
Yeah. To your knowledge, have you experienced increased attention or repression from the government in the wake of 9/11?
I have not been directly given any problem. I haven't had an FBI agent on my steps now for about 8 years, and I begin to get a little lonely because they used to come around about once a year, and I guess they've almost given me up as a total hard case that unless they've got a warrant, they might as well not even waste their time coming around because I never talk to them. And
five words, right?
Right, and I've been before two or three federal grand juries, and I don't talk to them either. And so I think once in a while, in fact, in the past, I think sometimes they've sent out some of their younger agents more or less as a joke than anything else to talk to me because, well, like the videotape we had been running on the website, we're going to run it again of an interview that the FBI tried to have with me 10 or 12 years ago. And it's,
I remember that. I saw it on the
site. It's a comedy. Yeah. So, but I don't know. I would expect, considering how vocal I am, that anything that they could possibly come up with, they may use to try to take me off the street. They were trying a long time ago with informants and agent provocateurs, but they never could get a hold of me until they got this civil thing going with Morris Dees up in Portland, Oregon. So they figured, well, if they couldn't get me on a criminal act, they would get me on a civil thing and take all my money, and then I couldn't operate and so forth. So, but there's been plenty of times when they've tried to set me up. But like I say, to my knowledge, lately, in the last very few years, I haven't detected any of that. Now, I may have had them around me, but the way I operate, it's quite difficult for them because I don't have a structured organization. I have very little access to a lot of the people that I deal with, and I'm so aware of people who may be trying to set me up that there's, you know, key words that come up, key sentences and so forth. Mm-hmm. And immediately the red light goes on. And so it's, you know, I've been down the road quite a ways. It's difficult for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking earlier, you mentioned about your organization is not really hierarchical. It's not structured.
Right.
Do you still advocate the leaderless resistance approach? I know there's been some criticism. Stephen Barry wrote an article about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes.
Do you still advocate leaderless
resistance? Oh, absolutely. Even more now. In fact, more and more of the people who used to be a little bit naysayers have come across to my way of thinking. More and more and more every day, every week tell me you were right all along. Because I've tried to get these guys away from marching and parading and demonstrating. I said, it's way past that now. Something can happen. You get picked up. You lose your job. They'll throw you in jail, and they're going to keep you there as long as they can. Chester Doles, his problem was that he had been providing, without knowledge, a great listening post for the federal agents. Infiltrators, and by having these public get-togethers, and this is something I used to argue with Dr. Pierce. I said, you keep saying you're totally legal. That doesn't mean anything, being totally legal, because as you can see, they infiltrate, they gain information, they get sometimes a person off to the side, talk them into some kind of a violent thing, the whole bit, and so with Chester Doles, once he said, I'm not going to do that anymore, and he made it abundantly aware on the web, the internet, that then he didn't have the value anymore to the federal people. And even, I know Chester wouldn't be very happy with thinking he was aiding the feds, but anybody, like, they're going to have a march and a demonstration and at the Alamo this Sunday, I believe it is, and I pleaded with these people. I said, look, don't do that stuff. You're just setting yourself up. You've got the police going to take you to the demonstration in their vans and so forth, and you're going to be under complete control of the opposition. I said, now, I don't think William Barrett Travis was taken to the Alamo by agents of the Mexican government to fight the Mexicans. And I don't think that the men who fought at Concord and Lexington were ferried there in wagons by British agents. You've got to understand, you're behind the lines. This is a war. And the more you put yourself in a position where an altercation could be started or something like that, or just simply getting a profile on you, then you become very useless to any future important activity.
Okay. There have been a lot of internet conspiracies bandied about that have gained currency at the far right, specifically that the Israeli Mossad and perhaps even the U.S. government had foreknowledge of the hijackers' intent on 9/11. You, I know, in the past have been skeptical about those kinds of stories. So what's your take on 9/11? Do you accept the government's...
Well, there's a lot of information floating around that bits and pieces that I guess you could make any kind of a story out of. After looking it all over, reading as much as possible, it's my opinion that the government doesn't operate that way. They wait for something to happen, and then when it happens, they put their own spin on it. And this way they can say, well, we didn't have anything to do with it, but when they leave hundreds of obvious Al-Qaeda radicals running around the United States, they leave the borders open where anybody can get on a plane and come here, they've got to know that the country is just teeming with foreign nationals that would like to serve a higher purpose or another country or another ideology. So it's sort of like the guy that goes down the street and just sprinkles gas all around on the street, and then he takes off, but then here comes a guy who flips a match, you know, lights a cigarette and flips the match, and the whole neighborhood goes up. And I think that either out of stupidity, and I can't write it that much off to stupidity or design. Well, if this happens, then we can do this. And if that happens, we can do that. And if this happens, we can spin it this way. And if that happens, we can spin it that way. But always circling the wagons and strengthening the state control.
What about the Israeli government? I know David Duke has argued that the Israeli Mossad had foreknowledge. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I don't think David Duke knows any more than anybody else on the street. It's possible that Mossad is a very clever, devious organization. And it's very possible that they might have had some knowledge. Probably it was something like something could be happening, but you could say that about anything, about any time something could happen. I have said that many times, like I said before, that I think something's going to happen, something's big's going to happen. I don't know when they're going to do it, but I'll bet you they're going to do it. And it's not any kind of magical clairvoyancy. It's simply reading the tea leaves or reading the papers and the financial papers and so forth. But I know one thing, that this incestuous relationship with Israel has allowed these people to become very criminal and really not our friend, at which they proved with the gunning of the
Liberty.
USS Liberty and the stealing of our atomic materials and building atomic bombs. They've got more weapons of mass destruction. And recently a professor made a speech over there in Israel that we have the nukes that we could take out every city in Europe and things like that. So we have absolutely no reason to have this relationship with Israel other than the religious factions and the economic factions, because they do use the Jewish people and businessmen a lot in their transnational corporation activities.
Okay.
But you see, the thing is, Israel is going bankrupt. Their economy is in terrible shape, and they're going to be asking for more money. And I think I think Jews have really shot themselves in the foot here too on this war thing, because you got half of the Jews against the war and half of the Jews for the war. And you have Jews obviously in power in the cabinet. They're super hawks. And now they're in a bad situation, and I think that they're going to end up with half of the people mad at them from one side and half the people mad at them from the other. I think their PR is going to be disintegrating as time goes on.
Yeah, they'll be too closely identified with the state.
Right.
Have you ever heard of the book The Fatal Embrace by a fellow named Ginsberg?
No, I haven't.
It was a book that came out about 10 years ago. His take on anti-Semitism was that at times Jews become too closely identified with the state, so opponents of the state can kind of link the two together as a way of opposing a regime that can use anti-Semitism as a way to mobilize against the state.
Well, that's probably true. I've always said that Jews throughout history have they've been found to be good at many things, and they have been incorporated on the side with many regimes, including China. Back in the old days when the Mongolians invaded and took over China, they didn't have the expertise for keeping track of the money and so forth. They brought in Jews to China. But when the Chinese got back in power, well, they ran the Jews out. There's synagogues, of course, still ancient synagogues in China, but the Jews have done that forever. I mean, they have become tax collectors and so forth for the state, like the kings and so forth. And of course, the church had a lot to do with that too, making it illegal for the non-Jews to collect interest and things like that. So they left these jobs wide open for Jews. So, yeah, I've said that I will push for Oh, what's his name? The Jewish guy that's going to run
Lieberman.
For... Huh?
Lieberman.
I'm going to support that because I told my people I want the Jew to be right out in front. I want him to quit hiding back in the back room and maybe in the cabinet or whatever. I want the Jew to be right out front where he can take the flak like everybody else. So I would tend to support Lieberman for president.
Yeah, well, maybe you can work on his campaign.
Well, I think that I could, and I think he wouldn't be too happy about it, but...
something to keep in mind. Do you have any thoughts on the impending war with Iraq, against Iraq?
Oh, I'm just sick about it. I'm actually, I have never been so sick because it's like Vietnam all over again. I went through the Vietnam thing. I wasn't in the military at the time, but my friends were, and I was right here by the biggest Marine base, and all these guys came back all shot up and amputees and everything, and I went through that, and what a horrible, useless adventure that was. And now, here we go again, and it just really wrenches my stomach to see another bunch of guys going over there, da-da-da-da, we're saving America and all that kind of stuff, and they're going to come back in body bags and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I just despise Bush for getting us into this.
What's your take on why the United States is going to war? There seems to be this notion, the far right, that it's a lot of Jewish neoconservatives who are really goading him into that. Do you accept that analysis?
Well, I think he's a pretty easy guy to goad because I don't think he's too bright. And I think that he probably does have some of these fundamentalist Christian ideas, and they're scaring the hell out of me because these people believe there's got to be a nuclear war in the Middle East before Jesus can come back. I mean, these people are frightening. And, you know, you got a guy there like, was it Ashcroft, putting clothes on the statues and stuff. I believe there's almost insanity going on in Washington. And, of course, I'm sure the people like Pearl, who has made millions off of these problems in the Middle East, you know, when he went over there and told the Arabs if they gave him $100 million that he would try to see that we gave him a better shake in the press, and that $100 million ended up in his private companies and stuff like that. So there are people taking advantage, and it seems like all these guys in the Republican cabinet are tied in some way at the hip with the arms makers or the oil people. So, but I think, I don't know, I think Bush is just weird. I think that this guy's could get away from him. I think that they want to use Bush for one thing or another, whether it's oil or what. But I think this guy is really, he may get away from him. And it appears to me like he has gotten away from him. I think it's a little like when Hitler went to see Tyson, the steel magnate and so forth in Germany, and Krupp and these guys, they told him, they said, look, we'll furnish raw materials and da-da-da-da-da. And they thought, well, it's just going to be one big happy thing. We'll be building arms forever and there'll never be a war. And we're going to be making money, 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 and everything will be great. But then all of a sudden, Hitler says, well, I'm invading Poland. And then these guys have to pay the price, you know. I just think that, I think the guy's nuts.
Yeah, the left-wing critique of this war centers on this notion of big oil. Do you find that to be a credible explanation?
Of course it's a big thing, because if this, any place where there's any kind of raw material and so forth, and oil, it seems like we go rushing there. You know, Somalia is loaded with oil, too, and we went rushing there. And Afghanistan is very rich in minerals and oil, and we went running there. And you don't see them running down to the Sudan or these places where where there are no particular resources. So I think the whole thing is the transnational corporations are pretty much in control of determining the whole future of the world at this time. I don't believe we have a sovereign government. I don't believe there's any sovereign governments left in the world that aren't extremely influenced by this transnational trading and so forth. And of course, this whole concept of a runaway consumerism too, that we gotta produce more, and you gotta consume, is sort of insane too.
Yeah, your critique sounds very left-wing, your notion of...
Yeah, I become more that way as, a lot more that way as I got older.
Have you moved away kind of from this notion of Zog? It seems like now you center more on transnational corporations.
Well, I realize that among the transnational corporation and international banking, the Jews are very heavy into that. And we do have a very dangerously skewed foreign policy that has to come back to the feet of Jews and elitists who have found it to be profitable to look the other way. So I haven't moved away from the Zog thing, but I keep promoting the fact that the Jews would have no power at all if it wasn't handed to them on a silver platter. So who is handing the Jews, if they're dangerous, why are they dangerous, and who is giving them that power? And I have to say, well, it's us. Whether it's the religious fanatics in this country or whether it's the economic people or the elitists in this country, I've always said if the elitists ever got really pissed at the Jews, it'd be a 48-hour operation. But as long as they find that Jews, or many Jews, are beneficial to their projects, they're going to be sort of simpatico with them, even though behind closed doors, as you remember how Nixon and all these people really talk about the Jews or what they really think of.
Like Billy Graham.
Yeah, all of them. See, they're hypocrites. They would tend to not like them, but, well, if we can make a deal, we'll work with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's about all I had, Mr. Metzger. Is there anything else you would like to add, or...
Well, it's just I've told people over and over that this 21st century is going to be the wildest century we've ever seen, and it's going to make the 20th century look like the 1950s happy days. Anything could happen at any time. I mean, great, great things are going to happen, and terrible, terrible things are going to happen, and it's going to be a roller coaster ride through this. I'll probably see at least some of it before I check out, but I'm telling you, it's going to be a wild ride, and anything can happen anywhere.
What do you think about the white racial nationalist movement? Any predictions of how they'll come out?
Well, you see, my position is to go for leadership and forget the masses at the present time, that they're too propagandized and brainwashed and so forth to spend time on. And that's where I differ with a lot of the right wing. They want to spend all this time thinking they're going to recruit Joe Blow. Well, Joe Blow, even if he was recruited, isn't going to do anything anyhow. So my position is to recruit the fanatical minority, that 1% or half of 1%, to build for a future time when we would have power within that small number, but fanatical, to really make change and not waste our time and money trying to draw the masses, because we feel that in any type of upheaval, people follow who's strong, sometimes even if they don't like them. Standing around on street corners trying to convince the general public that you're right is a waste of time, and that's where I have a strong disagreement with a lot of the conservative right-wing racially oriented people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Okay.
If you want, I'll get one of those books sent out to you when it's released. I might be able to have the publisher send it directly to you. Do you think you'd be interested in reviewing it?
Sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there I think you'd find interesting. I go into the development of leaderless resistance.
Yes.
The arguments for and against it, and I have a lot of good data.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, I don't support leaderless resistance as Sergeant Barry seemed to think as a panacea for all time.
Right.
I'm just saying during this time of our activity and the way the government is and so forth, that we're almost forced into it if we're to survive.
Right. It's just because of circumstances.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I go into that. I go into your take on it and Alex Curtis's take on it.
Yes.
And I have a lot of other stuff in there. I have some discussion and dialogue between me and Dr. Kirsch. You'd probably find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Okay. Well, I greatly appreciate you taking the time, Mr. Metzger, to discuss these issues with me. I'm sure it'll make a great contribution to my next study.
Well, good. It's nice talking to you.
All right. Okay. Take care.
You too.